President Trump points to China for breaking their end of the deal. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Vishala Sripathma, filling in for Anu Anand. Good morning. China broke the deal in trade talks, so they'll be paying. That's according to President Trump. His comments come ahead of talks with China later today and after Beijing said it would retaliate to the president's promise this week to more than double tariffs on Chinese goods. It's thrown a spanner in the works in the talks between the two countries who are working to end the trade war. David Collins is a professor of international economic law at the University of London.
So it looks like what's happened is the Chinese took what were binding commitments in the agreement and changed them to being sort of conditional agreements or best efforts agreements so that they wouldn't really be legally binding and they wouldn't be enacted into Chinese law. And when they did that, really, that means that they're not actually going to potentially have the legal consequences that the Americans wanted. I think it's unlikely that we'll see a resolution today. I think what you might see is some request from China to delay the tariffs by potentially offering some commitments, but I don't think that will work with President Trump. Not today.
That was David Collins. Let's do the numbers. Global shares are down for a fourth day running after the warning from President Trump. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong closed down 2.4%, while French stocks are currently down 1%. Meanwhile, shares in Ajax lost a fifth of their value after the Dutch football club crashed out of the European Champions League. After a day of protests, which saw its drivers go on strike in several cities around the world, Uber is still on track to make its debut on the New York stock market tomorrow. Yesterday's strikes showed its clear dominance in the world of taxi apps in major cities, but a space it hasn't managed to conquer is the rural town, as Benji Guy now reports.
With nearly 4 million drivers across 60 countries on its platform, Uber has come a long way from three test cars in San Francisco in 2010. But within those 60 countries, they are not ubiquitous. If you're in a major city, you shouldn't have a problem, but you'll probably struggle in more remote areas, where both supply and demand are an issue. This has left holes for other ride-hailing apps to fill, like Cabs.com here in the UK, set up by William Berry.
I thought maybe the only way that you could fight Uber is if you aggregated all of the cab firms together. I mean, if you live in a rural area, then you would just call your local cab firm. What we're basically doing is leveraging the power of an existing network.
Lack of cell phone reception and slow or no internet are also key factors behind this urban-rural technological divide. Rhoda Joseph is an associate professor of information systems at Penn State University.
For rural areas, they might not have access to broadband technology, they might have spotty cellular service, and it just makes it a lot more costly for utilization of some ride-sharing technologies.
There might be some ways to really stimulate some growth in rural areas by having transportation access. That's always a big issue.
But will improved broadband and cell phone coverage spell the end for companies like Cabs.com in the face of Uber's competition? William Berry again.
The challenge for Uber is going to be that as the market matures, people are going to start becoming a bit more price conscious. I think their investors are going to start jumping up and down and saying, okay, you know, you haven't made a penny in profit so far. When's the money coming in?
It looks like the ride-hailing app wars will continue for some time to come. In London, I'm the BBC's Benji Guy for Marketplace.
Now, how do we protect our jobs from automation? It's something that's been discussed a fair bit as we see the digital economy expand at a rapid rate. But are there measures we can take into our own hands to protect our jobs? It's an issue Montserrat Gomendio, head of skills at the OECD, has been looking at in a new report released today. She says one harsh reality facing many is a pay cut.
If you're in a highly skilled job, you have many other jobs that you can move to because you already have the skills. So the training effort to move to other jobs is very small. Even with low and moderate levels of training, there are about 60% of the occupations that they could move to. But if they don't want to accept a decrease in salary, if they don't want to accept a job which really has a very low demand on skills, this is reduced to about 5%. There are online
resources. Rely on businesses then to invest quite a bit of money in upskilling their staff and also presumably a reliance on government funding as well. What happens particularly in certain situations where maybe the government isn't in a position to do so?
Yes, well, the magnitude of the challenge is really big, and therefore governments, employers, unions and other stakeholders need to get together and to basically redesign skill systems so that adult learning is available to all. It's efficient and it's well aligned with the needs of the labor market. You know, one of the things which is a matter of concern to us is that the level of involvement of employers, governments, vocational education and training systems, universities depends on the country. But what we find systematically and consistently in all countries is that while people with high levels of skills are very motivated to engage in training and they will use every opportunity that is offered to them, people with low level of skills, which are those that are facing the higher risk that their jobs will be automated, do not engage in training. And the main obstacle, and we have compared many, many different variables, it's motivation. They don't see the point of engaging in training. They don't understand the returns. Therefore, this is something that governments need to tackle because it's a barrier that it's very difficult to overcome.
Montserrat Gomendio. And just before we go, lots of rather embarrassed faces in Australia today after the central bank discovered 46 million banknotes had a misprint in its microtext. In London, I'm Vishala Sripathna with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.